I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we will talk with United States Senator Dan Coats. Coats, a Republican, is retiring at the end of this term from his second stint in the Senate. He previously served in the 1990s. He also has served in the U.S. House of Representatives and as an ambassador. We will talk with him about what he has seen and learned from his years of service and what lies ahead for him. Please join the conversation. Call us at 866-476-3881. Our email is nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today with United States Senator Dan Coats, who is retiring at the end of his term, which will end at the beginning of the new year. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can give us a call at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, Senator, welcome back to the program. It's good to have you here.
Well, thank you. I'm a listener, and it's fun to be in the studio.
Yeah, I think the last time you were on the show, we were actually down in the community room. It's when you were running for the Senate 6 years ago. And I'm going to start this by saying you have seem to have an ability to surprise people, catch them a little off guard in that when you decided to run for the Senate again, that almost defied expectations. And then everyone kind of anticipated you were going to run for re-election this time around, and you caught people off guard. Could you walk us through what the process is deciding that now was the time?
Well, I was surprised in 2010 as much as everybody else was. I had no intention whatsoever of running again. I had been kind of screaming at the television for a couple of years as the Democrats had total control in Washington, and I think were passing legislation that wasn't where I thought the country ought to go. And so when I got the call that, we've searched the state and we can't get anybody to run against Evan Bayh that we think has a chance to win, we're sort of making one last call to see if you would consider coming back. I, at the time, was just about ready to accept a position at a major university. But I thought, well, I'm not sure I can live the rest of my life saying you didn't at least give it a shot, give it a chance, particularly if you're concerned about the direction of the country and what the future would be for your kids and grandkids and everybody's kids and grandkids. So I said yes. And that was a surprise as much to me almost as it was to everybody else. Now, at the other end of that, after 6 years, all of a sudden, I started thinking, well, not all of a sudden, but through the process, I started thinking about when is the time to pass on the baton to a younger generation. And it was clear to me that at having turned the age of 73, that 6 more years in the Senate, I'd be pushing maybe the limits of having the enthusiasm and the energy to – it's a demanding job, consuming job. Marcia and I have spent almost a lifetime throughout my career saying, you know, at some point we'll take slow down a little bit, do those things when we said, well, when we get there, we'll go and do this. I've got 10 grandkids now. I've missed a lot of birthdays. I've missed a lot of anniversaries. I've missed a lot of sporting events for a considerable amount of time. And I thought, it's time to really think about handing it over to the next generation of leadership. You can stay too long. And so I came to the conclusion 2 years out that this would be my final term. I didn't announce it until, a year and a half out, I guess. I announced that I would not be running. I wanted to give whoever wanted to run a chance to file and a chance to participate in this. And so I think in life you come to a point where you recognize it's time to hand the baton to the next generation. Hopefully you can encourage them to continue to follow the beliefs and principles that you've used, I've used to represent the people here of Indiana. And it just felt like it was the right thing to do at the right time.
I'm going to ask kind of the Frank Sinatra question, you know, from my way. Regrets, I've had a few. Did you, at any point, did you, after you made the decision not to do it, did you think, maybe I should give it one more go around? Because I've known you for a long time, and I know the issues you care about a lot.
I do, and not having not being in the arena and having a voice to try to influence the direction of the country and those issues, yes, I have thought about that. But every time I have weighed it in terms of the fact that there comes a time in everyone's life where you have to think about passing it on. I've seen too many people stay too long and haven't had that ability for failing health or for other reasons. And I just thought it was the right thing to do. And each time I think it through, I think I made the right decision.
I remember talking to you years ago, and you made it clear that actually holding elective office was not something you aspired to when you were younger. It wasn't really part of your life path. But one way or the other, you've been now in public service, either as a staff member for a congressman or a member of the House or an ambassador or member of the Senate for more than 30 years. Do you look back at your time and think, how did I get here at all?
John, I sure do. I never intended to have a career in politics. This was not my goal. We were living in Fort Wayne, Indiana. We were raising young children. I had a good job with an insurance company there. We thought our life was pretty well laid out before us. It was unusual that I had the opportunity to cross paths with Dan Quayle and that he reached out and asked me if I would take a leave of absence from the work that I was doing just to help him get started. And I still remember standing in the kitchen of our home in Fort Wayne promising my wife, this is just for 2 years. This is my contribution to good government.
Did she ever remind you of the, that kind of
Occasionally
that conversation?
Occasionally she does, yes. That turned into a remarkable way that doors opened that I never went to the door and pushed it open. They opened, and the opportunity there for additional public service presented itself. And I walked through that door, and I'm grateful for the opportunity that I've had to represent people. It's turned out to be a most exciting and challenging and rewarding career from just the standpoint that you are in fighting for what you believe. You're representing, you have the privilege of representing a state that I hold in high esteem and people that I, Hoosiers that I have come to love and respect the Hoosier way. Again, one thing led to another. Dan Quayle decided to run for the Senate and suggested that I think about running for the Congress. That was a family affair with the kids engaged and knocking on doors and had the privilege of being elected. And then when Dan Quayle was selected to run for vice president, that opened up the Senate seat. And my thanks to Bob Orr as governor, I had to fill that seat under Indiana law. I stood in a special election and then another election. But then the opportunities that came from being an ambassador and then being back in the Senate have been pretty extraordinary. And all of a sudden, I'm looking at a lot of years of public service.
What do you think you're going to miss about it the most?
Oh, being in the arena. There's just nothing like being in the arena and fighting for what you believe in and what you believe that the people you are representing believe in. I've tried to lay out with people, with voters, some agree and some don't agree with my principles and provisions, but I've tried to be very upfront with voters before they go to the ballot box as to what they can expect out of me in terms of the things I believe in, the principles that I make my decisions on, and their confidence and judgment, that I would have the judgment to make wise votes that would benefit Indiana in its future. And so I've tried to make that very much a part of who I am, be very transparent with the people that I represent. As I said, it's been quite an adventure.
What are you going to miss the least?
The frustration of not being able to accomplish what you went there to do. The frustration of knowing that the strong majority of Republicans and Democrats understand that we are in a very precarious fiscal situation by borrowing 40 cents of every dollar that we spend, that we have a government that is almost out of control in terms of spending, that we have problems overseas that have left us in a pretty difficult position right now, but yet letting politics intervene, let's do that after the next election, and there always is the next election. So the things that I really went there to do, to get done, to accomplish, even though it might have had negative political consequences for standing up what I believed in, haven't been fully realized. That's the electoral process. That's what the founding fathers put together, checks and balances. But there are big things, and I named two what I think are transcending issues that need to be addressed and will have to be addressed, and I don't want it to be addressed through a crisis. But those two are what I call the debt bomb and the terrorist bomb. The debt bomb is we cannot continue in this country to going down the road of borrowing 40 cents of every dollar. The tax collector, the bill collector, the lender is going to be knocking on the door, and it's going to have major consequences for us. We are saddling future generations with a debt that they may not be able to repay, and they, as a consequence, will not have the opportunities that my generation has had in terms of jobs, good employment, maybe living the American dream, buying a home, putting money aside for sending your kids to good schools, all the things that we have enjoyed from the sacrifices of the past. But yet on the path we are on, whether you're Republican, Democrat, liberal, conservative, the numbers are the numbers. Mitch Daniels said it's simple math. You just look at your household. If you were having to go to the bank every week to borrow 40% of the money that you're spending, at some point the bank says, we're not lending anymore. And you put yourself in a terrible situation. The terrorist bomb is, I think, the future threat that this country faces of the marriage of terrorists with weapons of mass destruction. If that plane that ran in, those two planes that ran into the Twin Towers in New York, were carrying a radiological, biological, or chemical weapon in them, we would not be talking about 3,000 deaths. We would be talking about 3 million deaths. We know that terrorists have the capabilities and potentially the resources to be able to buy or receive from North Korea, other states, nation states that have a nuclear capability and chemical and biological capability. We know that that threat has come to our shores. We've seen some attacks. Thank goodness it hasn't involved something at that level that I've been talking about. But that is a future threat that needs to be addressed, and it hasn't been addressed, in my opinion, in the way that it should. So those two transcending issues, I think, top everything else. I will miss not being in the fight for that. I've spoken out hundreds of times, done everything I possibly can with my colleagues to convince them that this has to rise above politics. It can only be done with bipartisan support to address these two major threats that will threaten the future of this country.
And I know we're getting a little close on time for the break, and we can pick it up on the other side. But you mentioned Mitch Daniels, and I remember several years ago when they were talking about debt discussions, and there was a proposal on there for $1 worth of tax increases for, I think it was like $9 worth of cuts, and many of the people in the Republican Party just said no. And his response was, yeah, I'll take that deal every time. But part of the frustration he was expressing at that point is, we can't even negotiate or compromise on these things. Do you see that there's going to be a point where we can sit down and compromise or talk our way through these things?
John, there'll have to be a point. It will come. You just don't want it to come in times of crisis. I mean, yeah. Think Greece or what happened in Europe when the funding collapsed and the whole system was on the verge of collapse. So think of what we went through with Lehman Brothers. So it's unsustainable, and we're going to have to work together. What's been frustrating is that we have pushed it into the political system, and we haven't had leadership that has risen to the occasion.
If you are just joining us, we are talking with United States Senator Dan Coats, who is retiring at the end of this year from his second stint in the Senate. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Again, we're talking with Senator Coats. He will be here for the entire hour. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking today with United States Senator Dan Coats, who is retiring at the end of this term. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. So before we went to the break, we were talking about sort of the frustrations of dealing with the system. And I guess because you can look at this from a somewhat different perspective than a lot of people who are involved in the process, in that you were in the House of Representatives in the 80s during the Reagan era and Bush era, and then you served in the Senate in the 90s, and then you kind of went away for a while. I mean, you literally were out of the country for a good period, and you came back and rejoined this thing, the domestic political process anyway, when, you know, the gridlock, pick whatever term you want, you seem to have intensified. I'd just like to ask, I mean, how have things changed from when you were in the Senate before, and if so, in what ways?
Well, dramatically. When I was first in the Senate, you represented your state. You did your fundraising within your state. The amount of money you needed to raise was reasonable compared to today's situation. You didn't have social media in place that everything was breaking. All of a sudden, everything is breaking news. That wasn't the case back then. You had a limited number of media outlets. You could do things like we're doing here, talking things through, getting into depth. All of a sudden, it turns into sound bites, breaking news. Whether the attention span of the American public has shortened dramatically or whatever, it's just like blasted at you over and over and over. And it comes from all parts of the world, and it's 24/7. Mm-hmm. So both on the fundraising side, which back then was very reasonable. You, as a senator, you would basically serve 4 years, total focus on being a United States senator, representing the people. You'd spend the last 2 years reaching out to your constituents who, if they liked what you were doing, would support you, send out mailings, hold some fundraisers around the state. All of a sudden in 2010 now, and now even more so in 2016, both the fundraising aspects with no limits from outside sources, putting up messages that the candidate can't control. Anybody who wants to buy an ad and a super PAC or something, putting ads on, they can say whatever they want to say, and they can't coordinate with the member. And secondly, we're talking now tens of millions of dollars to run a Senate race versus just the low millions of dollars, I think, I was at the, 2.5 level during my first Senate race, maybe a little bit more than that.
And that was considered a fair amount of money at that point.
It was considered a fair amount of money, and you had to work for it. Yeah. But as I said, you had 4 years to be a senator, 2 years to put more focus on your election coming up. Now, when senators get elected, they have to start the next day preparing for the next six years when election comes up, because outside forces can put millions of dollars in against them, And so they have to raise money to counteract that, to get their side of the story. And then whatever is said or done, it just goes viral through the social media, and you're constantly having to explain, well, why did you say that or do this? I believe in transparency, mm-hmm. but it's just a different day. And I think there's far too much emphasis now on the political scene and far too little emphasis on the policy scene. We are elected to go there and enact good, sound policies that benefit the future of our state, our people, and the nation. And we spend too little time doing that and too much time in the politics.
Is it tougher now because of some of the changes you've talked about to be deliberative, which is one of, you know, the reason that senators have a longer term than not just members of the House, but the president? I mean, they've got 6-year terms. They're supposed to be somewhat removed from those public pressures. We had former Senator Lugar down to the college about a week and a half ago he was talking about many of the same things you're talking about right now. One of the things that stuck in my head, though, is he said, that there's an awful lot of wisdom in the world that cannot be compressed into 140 characters. And because we have to communicate so rapidly and so abruptly these days, that doesn't allow for the kind of distillation that the Senate was supposed to provide.
I agree with that. The Senate is not doing what the Founding Fathers designed it to do. They designed it to take, to give a 6-year term to the elected so that they could focus their efforts on policy and not worry about the politics. The House of Representatives was supposed to, on 2-year terms, represent the will of the people at the moment. The Senate was supposed to stand back just a bit and look at what is the long-term consequence of doing X, Y, or Z. How does this match the tradition of the direction the founders wanted us to go? What are the constitutional ramifications, plus or minus? And that is not what the Senate is today. I hope that's what it goes back to at some point. Given the dramatic changes in how the media is able, hundreds of challenge of cable media that is trying to top each other, who can be the most sensational so that they grab more readership or leadership. That has dramatically changed the role of the United States Senate, I think, to the detriment of the country, because we don't have that time to deliberate. We don't have that time to think through, is this really the direction that we want to go? And work it through the public with the kinds of things you and I are doing right now. When I start talking about the debt, or when I start talking mm-hmm. about threats to our country, I can't put that into a soundbite. Well, I mm-hmm. could put it into a soundbite, but there's no context and there's no depth to, yes, okay, Senator, I agree with you about that. But then you said, but how are you going to accomplish that?
Mm-hmm.
And how long is it going to take? And what do you think the consequences will be? What are the pluses and the minuses of that? That's what the Senate is supposed to do, think those things through, and they're supposed to have the time to do it. But now, probably some people are saying, Dan Coats is going on way too long here.
No, we have a smart audience.
What's the 9 words
yeah.
answer to the question?
We are talking with U.S. Senator Dan Coats here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, on Twitter at WFYI. You can do what this caller has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Caller, you're on the air.
Yes, hello?
Hello, yes. What's on your mind?
Yes, I'd like to thank the senator for taking his time today to speak. I had a question or concern, want to know if he could speak to this subject. I would like the senator to explain to his future predecessor how important the philanthropic component of our society and culture will be for that individual once they're elected for Hoosiers, and how that affects Hoosiers.
Oh, I like that question. I like that question because particularly in my first term in the Senate, I spent a great deal of time and effort trying to promote the role of community and faith-based organizations that reach out and provide services to people within their jurisdiction, within their state, within their localities. There are limits to what the government can do in providing support for people who are having any kind of any one of a whole range of difficult issues that, to try to deal with. And I have seen the contrast between the impersonal, one-size-fits-all, Washington has the solution to the problem, and the volunteer efforts and nonprofit efforts and the reach out of people in their neighborhoods, in their communities, in philanthropic ways to help address situations. I visited organizations throughout the state of Indiana, everything from the Homeless Center in South Bend, which is a coalition of 300 and some churches of all faiths with the University of Notre Dame, the city and the county. It is a model for the kind of programs that ought to be put in place for dealing with homelessness. I have seen the federal efforts and the failure of the federal efforts to, you know, they can put a roof over someone's head, they can put food on their table, but they can't transform lives and teach people the skills that they need to become workers in the workplace, to become self-sufficient. I've traveled the country. I was chairman of the Children, Youth, Family Committee, looking at programs and comparing the federal programs to what was being done at local communities through churches, through synagogues, through mosques, through any kinds of religious organizations, and with well-meaning people volunteering their time and their heart, in addition to their wallets and tax money, that to reach out to people and do things. I could name a 100 organizations in Indiana, maybe more than that, that are doing things below the radar, not seeking a lot of credit for what they do. You look at Wheeler Mission here, you look at some of the teen pregnancy centers, you look at some of the food banks, you look at Catholic social services, the whole range of things. It's remarkable. And that needs to be encouraged, not discouraged. The tendency is to say, oh, Washington can do it. We'll send our money to Washington and they'll listen, what they can do on one size fits all doesn't fit the small community, doesn't fit the medium town. And it doesn't recognize and support those who, through their generosity and through their commitment of time and effort on a volunteer basis, makes a difference in people's lives.
I'm going to ask this because it gets to that question of change. When you ran in 2010, you came back, there actually were people, in part because you were talking about trying to find ways. You were talking about finding using government to do it, but find ways to help people who struggled in life or who were underserved, underrepresented, and all of that. Finding faith-based, but even that, the party had changed in the time that you were away. There are elements of the Republican Party think, you know, that it should be fairly Darwinian. I remember having a conversation with our mutual friend Russ Pulliam. And Russ was looking at writing a column at the time about, you know, defending your conservative credentials. He said, how can anybody say Dan Coats is not a conservative? But in part, it was because the party had shifted from, like, you know, George H.W. Bush's 1,000 points of light or even George W. Bush's compassionate conservatism to a really stark kind of libertarianism. There's a strong wing there. Was it difficult to step back into that and to make the case that, okay, yeah, we disagree that the federal government ought to do this, but somebody ought to do it. Somebody ought to be helping these folks.
Well, it was unfortunately transcended by some events, partly. I remember before he took office, George W. Bush, talked to me about the efforts that I had made earlier in the Senate on conservative way of showing compassion, providing for a safety net, and honoring and using and encouraging the faith-based local nonprofit organizations to supplement what the government couldn't do in many instances. And he was told me he wanted to make that a very central piece of his presidency. 9-1-1 came along, and it changed everything. And the focus then went on, how do we respond to this? Today we see ISIS, and we see the threats coming home, whether it's in Boston or whether it's in New York or whether it's in California, the random attacks. And so the threat level is different. it is a responsibility of the federal government with local law enforcement to provide everything they can to keep us safe from that. But it has shifted the focus. And the second thing is the fact that we have not directed our funding efficiently and effectively at the federal level, hence all the debt that we're going into. We're wasting a lot of money that could be used to address some of these issues. And so it's a different day today than it was before. But I do think we need to come back to it. And we need to come back to it because, frankly, the federal government is running out of money. So much money is going to mandatory spending that whether you're talking about the research at NIH for health benefits in the future, whether you're talking about education support or any of a number of other issues, we simply don't have the resources for that anymore because we are so in debt and paying ever-increasing interest on that debt. And we see the entitlements running away with our revenues. And so some startling statistics have been put out, not by Republicans, not by Democrats, Libertarians, or whatever, but by agencies that are just simply looking at the math, saying you've got to get control of this, or you're not going to be able to pave roads, build infrastructure, support medical research, support education, and provide the kind of support that people who are in need, who've lost their jobs, who are in tough situations. And so there's ever more need for outside local help, volunteer basis and so forth. And that's going to continue until we can get a hold of our budget.
If you are just joining us, we are talking with retiring United States Senator Dan Coats. If you'd like to join the conversation, please send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI, on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what Deborah has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Deborah, welcome to the program.
Hi, good afternoon. Good afternoon, Senator Coats. I just have a couple of questions. Actually, I'll just only ask you one. It seems that Merrick Garland actually has gotten the respect, is respected by both conservatives and by both Republicans and Democrats, and is just considered to be someone who is certainly worth being considered by, should be at least voted on in the Senate. What have you done to sort of try to at least bring his Barack Obama's nominee to be voted on, at least to be given a chance to be heard and to be voted on?
Deborah, yeah, we're coming up on a break. I'm going to give the senator a chance to respond. Thank you very much for the call and the question.
Thank you.
Well, this may be an issue that we will deal with after the election. What has happened is it became very political with the presidential election coming forward. We need to address that open seat. But the decision was made that we ought to take it out of politics when we are nominating someone to the Supreme Court, and that it would be a good thing to do. And I hope we will take up this issue following the election as we go back into session, in the so-called lame duck session. And we're going to need to look at how we go forward. We will have the election will be behind us. I think in terms of nominating and confirming as someone for the Supreme Court involves a great deal of judgment and a lot of responsibility on us to get a person in there that we know is going to be in there for a long, long time making decisions about the future of the country.
If you are just joining us, we are talking with retiring United States Senator Dan Coats. He will be leaving the Senate at the end of this year or the very beginning of next year. I guess you've got a few hours in January in which you are a senator. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimitswfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. I am John Krall. You are listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking with retiring United States Senator Dan Coats on No Limits today. If you have a question, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. Have a question via Facebook from our regular listener, Gary, that deals with Social Security. And he raises questions about the solvency of the system and the folks that it seems to serve, unless they have almost a terminal condition. We talk a little bit because Social Security is one of those things that is an election perennial. Obviously, it comes up. But there is reason to doubt the long-term stability of the program.
Well, there's real reason to doubt it, because not because a Republican says it or a Democrat says it. There's real reason because the trustees of the Social Security Trust Fund regularly release reports. And they are ringing the alarm bell to Congress and saying, you have got to step up and do something with this, because if you don't, this thing is going to be insolvent and people are going to be hurt. I don't know of a member of Congress that wants to eliminate Social Security. This is a retirement plan that people have paid into throughout their whole working life. They want those payments there when they retire. They banked on them. So no one wants to take that away. But we have to recognize the fact that the trustees basically saying, we are paying out more money than we're taking in. We have tried to make adjustments to this, but those adjustments have not been made to the extent that, and now they're projecting that with 10 years or less, we will be in a situation where either major reductions in payments or massive tax increases will have to be imposed on the people under Social Security. What bothers me is that this is not even much of an issue. Neither side is putting forward a plan in terms of how they're going to deal with this. The next president, whether they like it or not, is going to have to deal with Social Security, and it's not responsible to simply say, promise something that they know they can't fulfill. And so I've been out of tear on this for a long, long time. And unfortunately, once again, politics comes in, and you see the ads on TV now. This candidate is going to take away your Social Security, push grandma over the cliff in her wheelchair, you'll never get a penny. That is just totally irresponsible. Everybody in Congress, regardless of their party, knows the situation we're in and knows it. But the answer always is, let's do it after the next election. Well, there's always the next election. And so it doesn't get done. And what the last thing we want is for there to be a crisis. And there was one back in 1983. I was serving in the House of Representatives. I think it takes leadership from the top. Ronald Reagan reached out to Tip O'Neill and said, Tip, we got a problem. Come up to the White House. And he told Tip O'Neill, if you and I don't stand together, Republican president and leader of the House of Representatives, most powerful Democrat, and if we don't tell our political arms to stand down on this, we're going to have payments are going to stop in 4 months. And they went together, and we passed something. It bought 30 years of solvency for it by gradually increasing the retirement age. We're all living longer, thankfully, and able to work a little longer, thankfully. There are changes that could be made that will make this program solvent, but it takes courage to rise above the politics of it, and the next president is going to have that challenge.
Got a listener who wanted to come back to the Merrick Garland question, and I want to build on the story you just told with that, because that's the kind of dynamic that frankly seems to be missing in D.C. And I'm not going to make this a partisan issue. It seems to have gone that way from, you know, whether there is a Democrat or a Republican in the White House, and an ability for the parties to function together or to compromise. Is there any realistic hope that we're going to get to the point where a Republican and a Democrat can sit down and say, we got a problem, we have different ideas about how to solve it, but we're going to basically lock ourselves in a room and we're going to figure out how we solve this, in a way that we both can get behind. Is there any hope that that's going to be achievable in the near future?
Well, hope springs eternal. We're in a very partisan standoff right now. The election may or may not help us resolve that. But as I've just said in my last response on Social Security, it takes extraordinary leadership from the top to be able to suspend the political war and stand above that and get together and do what is right for the future of the nation. I think the public is hungry for something like that, because what we don't want is to have to wait for the crisis to hit. And when the crisis hits, mistakes will be made. Money will be thrown at something to try to fix the problem. We saw this happen. We knew we had an issue with health care. One party, without any support from the other party, pushed through the Obamacare program, and now the thing is literally collapsing. And major, major changes are going to have to be made on it. We just saw the news that the premiums are going up 25% or more in some states. Insurance companies are dropping out of the program because they're losing money. We need bipartisan efforts to rise above the politics and to solve some of these problems. And this next president is going to have to do that. And they're going to have to get it looks like we're going to be split again in terms of party, which house and White House and so forth. So the next president's going to have to stand up and make some of these things happen.
We are talking with U.S. Senator Dan Coats here on No Limits. John, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you.
And certainly.
Senator, thank you for your years and years of service to the state and to the country.
Thank you.
I heard this weekend somebody said, if this is where we are, then where in the world are we going? And it got me to thinking about, you know, both parties in the duopoly today are very deeply divided. I wonder if you think, would it be a good thing or a bad thing if they did reform and that, you know, we had more parties than we do today trying to govern us in Washington?
Good question. Thanks very much for the
call.
That
is a good question, because I've been asked that question as I get around the state. You know, we have a sort of a we have a two-party system. We've had third-party candidates, but they've never been able in past elections, and they've never been able to gain the traction that the two parties have. Having served in Europe and watching the parliamentary system, where one party forms a coalition among many, many parties, has its pluses and minuses. It can provide cooperation between the parties if they form the coalition and make concessions as to what they will do and how they go forward. But it also has its downside. We see coalitions that just simply are deadlocked also, or don't work because there's such diversity there. So the U.S. has, I think, benefited from a two-party system from the standpoint that you have the voter has a pretty clear way of evaluating which direction the country wants to go, which vision for the future, and the kind of legislative action that that takes place in order to drive us in one direction or another. And you see the polls all the time. Do you think the country's going in the right direction, or do you think the country's going in the wrong direction? That forces, I think, a debate to be settled at the election time as to which direction the American people want to go. And so it does have its benefits. I think it's going to be very difficult for us to move to a coalition type of system where you have a proliferation of parties. And the 12% sign up with the 18%, sign up with the 9% and maybe get to 51. I've seen a lot of bickering between the parties, even though they formed the coalition to be in control. I saw a lot of that in Germany and in other European countries. So I guess I have mixed feelings about which is the better way to go. But I do think clarity, if the parties can define the direction they want to go, they're going to reach the public of this is then going to make that determination. And I think, once again, that's teed up here for this election to come.
Do you think, in speaking to that, because I think His question also spoke to the fact that, you know, there is a very conservative wing of the Republican Party now with Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, a very liberal wing. But there are a lot of centrists right now who feel, if not disenfranchised, disconnected from the process. Is there room there for perhaps disaffected moderate Republicans and moderate Republicans to join hands and create something resembling a political movement or a new political party?
That's a question I really don't have the answer for. I mean, you're right. Within the parties, there are major divisions on both sides. Bernie Sanders tapped into a significant wing of the Democrat Party, and Ted Cruz, during his run, tapped into a significant part of our party on the far right side. Donald Trump is not your typical candidate, and he's tapped into the frustration and anger that a lot of people have toward Washington, toward, quote, the establishment. And so I think we see a lot of churning going on right now within each party. And I think the party that is best able to reconcile some of their differences and put together a vision for the future that's compelling will be the party that is going to get elected in the fall. But I think each party now, despite what happens in this election, has got to do some soul searching in terms of who are we, how can we unite, around a vision for the future of this country. And I think that's going to be a difficult task because regardless of what happens, I'm not sure that the parties are going to coalesce around the one candidate, many, many people on each side having real reservations about their nominees. Hillary Clinton, no secret, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are two of the most unpopular people that have ever been nominated for president of the United States. And how the public sorts all this out at the election polls coming up here in just a less than a couple of weeks will probably give us an indication of where we're going with that. But I've been perplexed and amazed at what has happened in this election year. It's breaking all conventional wisdom. And I think it's going to have to sort itself out, and I think that'll take some time.
We are talking with United States Senator Dan Coats here on No Limits. Don, welcome to the program.
Well, I'm wondering why we've had 150,000 Christians from the Middle East apply for political asylum in this country, and if there's a difference in between a political asylum and coming in as a refugee, why can't it be combined where they can come in? Because we've had thousands and thousands of Muslims come into this country. And the last I've heard, we've had 67 from the Middle East that's been admitted to this country. Now, I know 150,000 of them, and I saw this on television. The second time it was presented to Obama, it was shown on television. They have sponsors, yet he turned it down. And we're not getting any of those people, which have been slaughtered and run out of their own country, which was the Middle East also. And they're not getting to come into the country. Why?
Okay. Thanks very much for the call and the question, Don.
Well, we have a immigration system right now that is broken. It is not working. It needs reform. It needs a couple of things, I think, before we can get that reform. Number one, we need to tighten our borders and make sure that those who are coming here legally. My mother was an immigrant. I'm the son of an immigrant. It's an amazing American story that you can be the son of an immigrant and actually hold the position of and run for a United States Senate or run for president. So we have had a system in the past that has benefited this country immensely, but that system currently is broken. And until we solve that first problem, we're going to continue to have impacts all the way down the line in terms of guest workers, in terms of asylum seekers, and so forth. Then it's complicated also by the fact that we have intelligence, significant intelligence, and I serve on that committee those who claim to be one thing are seeking to come into this country by trying to take a position that they aren't, and then do harm to people when they get here. And so the screening system has to be put in place, I think, to recognize legitimate eligibility in that regard. Now, I understand the question about asylum, and I understand the issue about Christians wanting to leave the horrendous situation that exists in the Middle East. We just had an effort with an amendment led by John McCain grant asylum to translators for our troops that have their lives at risk and their families' lives at risk. And unfortunately, that was denied by Harry Reid to even allow a vote on that. And so once again, we have this thing tied up in politics, and without the necessary reform of the immigration system, we're going to continue to see, and also putting in place a screening program to ensure that the people granted asylum are the ones that are eligible for that, and that it hasn't been seeded with people, as we know ISIS is doing and trying to do desperately, to bring people from the battleground over there and turn it into a battleground over here.
We are getting close on time, so I got to ask, after you step down, are you going to go back to screaming at the television set, as you said earlier? What is the next step, the next chapter for you?
Well, I've deliberately decided not to decide. First of all, we have the ethics compliance that we cannot negotiate for a position beyond until our term is finished, and I want to honor that. So I have had connections with the Sagamore Institute here in the past. I helped co-found it with its current president, Jay Hine. It's a nonprofit. It does great social work. Speaking of philanthropy, it's a non-paying association. I used to head up the board, which I had to drop when I went back to the Senate. So I will be here in Indiana. This is our home, our permanent home, and will continue to be. But I'm not in any kind of negotiation in terms of what I will do. All I know is this: my DNA won't allow me just to sit around and scream at the television set. I'll be active, but it won't be in politics.
And this is a cliche, but I mean it. Thank you very much for your service to the state. And
thank you. It's been a great privilege.
I'd like to thank Senator Coates and all of our listeners for what has been a lively discussion. I am John Krall. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Cherzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.